Hillary Clinton told a crowd at Exeter High School she wants students to be able to attend public colleges and university without taking out loans. She says she'd create incentives for states to spend more on education and for colleges to control their spending. And she wants to allow people to refinance existing student debt.
This is just common sense. If you're going to hear people in this campaign talk to you about improving the economy, helping incomes rise, then ask them what they're going to do to make college affordable and begin to deal with the debt burden that is holding too many Americans back.
Clinton proposes capping itemized tax deductions for the wealthy at 28% to help pay for her plan. Fellow Democrats Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley have already released proposals aimed at reducing the cost of higher education. Sanders has proposed taxing activity on Wall Street to make public colleges tuition-free. For NHPR News, I'm Josh Rogers.
Kasich spoke yesterday at a First in the Nation presidential forum with NHPR. Responding to a question about the political outsiders currently leading in the Republican polls, Kasich sounded confident.
It's sort of like if you have a football team that's 0-8, you start thinking about pulling somebody out of the stands to come in and play football. But you know what happens when game time comes? We make a couple trades, we change the lineup a little bit, but we don't pull people out of the stands. And I think that's what's going to happen ultimately in this political election.
Kasich also outlined positions on Syria, immigration, and healthcare reform. For NHPR News, I'm Jason Moon.
When Rubio came into the Secretary of State's office to file Thursday, it wasn't quite the crowd that Trump attracted, but the Florida senator did bring his own entourage of supporters. After filling out the paperwork and handing over the required $1,000 check, Rubio then took questions from the press, most of which revolved around Trump. Trump has recently criticized Rubio for using a Republican Party credit card for personal expenses when he was Speaker of the Florida House.
I find it ironic that the only person running for president that's ever declared a bankruptcy four times in the last 25 years is attacking anyone on finances.
On Friday, Republicans Chris Christie and John Kasich will be filing for the First in the Nation primary. For NHPR News, I'm Paige Sutherland.
A day after chiding the media for, as he put it, allowing Trump to play them like a violin, it was Jeb Bush who first brought up the real estate mogul during a panel discussion with young professionals. Bush was asked to name two historical figures and one celebrity he'd invite to a party. His answer came fast.
I wouldn't invite Donald Trump.
Winston Churchill and Neil Armstrong would be welcome, said Bush, but it was a firm no thanks on the celebrity.
I really don't believe in celebrity.
No.
I just don't. I don't. I find it superficial.
Throughout his remarks, Bush cast himself as a candidate who understands the responsibility of being president and takes it seriously. Trump, insisted Bush, doesn't. And he suggested it would be embarrassing for New Hampshire if Trump were to win here.
New Hampshire takes its First in the Nation primary status, in, you know, really seriously. And I don't think they're going to support a person who, in the end, is not a serious candidate. It kind of damages their brand.
Right now, it's Bush's brand that's on the line, and polls show him lagging well behind Trump. Both men campaign in New Hampshire Thursday night, Bush in Milford, Trump in Portsmouth. For NHPR News, I'm Josh Rogers.
Trump was on stage for just a few minutes. The New England Police Benevolent Association announced their endorsement. Trump stood by his proposal to block Muslims from the country. Then he told the small room of law enforcement officers what one of his first executive orders would be if he's elected.
That anybody killing a policeman, policewoman, police officer, anybody killing a police officer, death penalty. It's going to happen, okay? Can't go. We can't let this go.
Trump may have been in and out, but hours before he rolled in, protesters were lining up along Russell Street. 300 or so people hold up signs with messages like, "Love Trump's hate," "We welcome refugees," signs that compare Trump to Adolf Hitler, signs with words written in light.
The problem is that he's done this. It's not one mistake, you know, my friend.
He's made this again and again.
He does.
Mike Verney's trying to talk to the small group of Trump supporters that stand on one edge of the crowd. His sign reads, "We support our Muslim countrymen."
I'm proselytizing, but I'm also, you know, genuinely interested why they support Trump.
Just a few feet away, a Trump campaign-owned white pickup truck parked here on the street gets its alarm triggered from folks crowded so close to it. The alarm is Trump's campaign song, Twisted Sister's "We're Not Gonna Take It," on loop. Mike Verney keeps standing there.
Trump, to me, is expressing some of the worst elements of a nativist, bigoted background that has no place in this country in the 21st century.
That Twisted Sister car alarm goes on for at least another hour. Protesters do too. Stephen Stepanak, a state representative and Trump campaign co-chair, stands at the top of the hotel driveway, keeping his distance.
Now, this is Portsmouth. This is the San Francisco of New Hampshire. That's what these people do. Doesn't matter who it is, they come out and protest.
This event tonight's unusual for a Trump visit because it's not open to the public, just members of the union. The few people who did decide to show up but won't get in huddle up with Stepanak as they get word that Trump will be arriving soon.
Who's going to make America grand again? Did you know that?
One of them is Steve Lozenak. He's a fisherman from Newbury, Massachusetts, about to turn 69 years old. He says he hasn't been this excited about a candidate since John F. Kennedy.
He was real, just as Donald is real.
I ask Lozenak what his feelings are about the pushback Trump is getting from people around the world, including across the street. That sparks five people all at once saying, it's just the media. What's your reaction
well, no,
to that?
Not, not a lot of people. You know who's doing that? The media
no,
is doing
it's
that.
Not you guys.
No, it's the media.
They're scared of them. They're scared of them.
Mark Croteau's been holding a Trump sign all night. He walks over to listen. He wears a Ten Commandments T-shirt and leans the sign down against the brick wall.
So I don't know if I'm a supporter or not. I'm kind of neutral.
Croteau's been a trucker. Right now, he does construction around Boston. He says he got off early tonight and decided to check Trump out.
I heard the other day that he said that Donald said that he didn't mind being compared to Hitler. I thought that was really bizarre.
Right then, the fleet of black SUVs pulls up. In a flash, Trump gets out, gives a wave, takes three steps into the building. Woo! Croteau and the other supporters stand there, savoring the moment they've been waiting for all night. For NHPR News, I'm Natasha Haverty.
I know in 2013, you told 7 Days in Vermont that, quote, if you pass the strongest gun control legislation tomorrow, I don't think it will have a profound effect on these tragedies.
No,
do you still believe that?
But do you think that if we pass gun, you have hundreds of millions of guns in this country? I mean, I think the president said it very well. And that he said after the Oregon shootings, he said, you know, this is a very, very difficult problem. And there is no simple solution. But that just because there's not a simple solution does not mean that we do not do everything that we can. Do you think there's anybody who's going to guarantee you? Do you have a solution?
Well,
anybody out here have
a
solution?
Your thinking changed, I guess.
I'm saying that we do the best that we can. But anybody who is going to guarantee you that if you pass A, B, and C, and D, when you got hundreds of millions of guns in this country, that you're going to necessarily prevent the kind of tragedies, they're not telling you the truth.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good to see you.
It's a familiar sight. Carly Fiorina's campaign has a meet and greet at a lumberyard in Wentworth. Nitza Ioannidis and Carrie Marsh stand behind a table signing in guests. Ioannidis hands you a red Carly for America sticker and a brochure. Marsh might recommend a poster.
Yeah, anything you guys want. Thank you, enjoy the event.
You might think these women work for Fiorina's campaign, known as Carly for President. You'd be wrong. They work for Carly for America, the pro-Fiorina super PAC. In fact, that day in Wentworth, Fiorina and most of her staffers didn't show up until after Fiorina's talk was scheduled to begin.
Hi, I'm Leslie.
Leslie Shett, the press secretary for Fiorina's super PAC, was there early.
What we do is focus a lot on essentially the ground game.
At events, the super PAC often brings as many staffers as the campaign itself. They keep track of event attendees and distribute posters. What they don't do...
No, we don't communicate with the campaign.
It's like planning a wedding without being allowed to talk to the bride or groom. Super PACs rose in the wake of a 2010 Supreme Court decision that loosened restrictions on campaign finance. The court declared that people and corporations could donate unlimited sums to independent groups. The only catch? They can't coordinate directly with candidates' campaigns. So far, other super PACs spend money safely from the sidelines, pouring millions and millions into TV advertising.
We need a president willing to challenge the whole culture in our nation's capital. And I mean to do it.
That's paid for by Jeb Bush's super PAC, Right to Rise. Bush's official campaign, theoretically, had nothing to do with the ad. Other candidates, Hillary Clinton and John Kasich, for example, have similar strategies. In New Hampshire, Carly Fiorina's super PAC takes a different approach. Ray LaRaja is Associate Professor of Political Science at BU. He says super PACs can fill a gap for candidates who face better-funded opponents.
She doesn't have high name recognition. She's not like the ideologues on the right and left, like Senator Cruz from Texas, who gets a lot of passionate small donors. She doesn't have that national ideological constituency. So she relies on her wealth. Her friends were wealthy.
In fact, a handful of finance CEOs in California and New York did get Fiorina's super PAC off to a nice start, writing $100,000 checks. Not to mention the $1 million from Jerry Parenchio, former CEO of Univision. Neither super PAC nor campaign is willing to talk much about how they get around without communicating. But according to Shett, the super PAC waits for the campaign to publish a press release with the information they need. She put it like this.
Once an event is public and the campaign sends it out, then we do our best to try to help fill the bleachers.
And so, on the ground, staffers from Carly for President and staffers from Carly for America engage in a sort of silent tango. In July, Fiorina stopped by a popular Portsmouth cafe between campaign events. While she ate lunch, three super PAC staffers took turns keeping an eye on the candidate.
That one's fine. I'm going to get food.
Okay.
Yeah. It'll take us like 10 minutes.
If all three stepped out for their lunch or for phone calls, they'd have no way to know when Fiorina was finished or where she was heading next. Ray LaRaja calls this kind of maneuvering extraordinary.
They're trying to read each other's signals without being overt. And so she, in that sense, is on the cutting edge. In this presidential campaign, because she really can't cross that line.
Overall, the strategy of using super PAC dollars to pay for things usually managed by a campaign appears to be working just fine. As Fiorina says,
we started this campaign literally from a standing start on May 4th. We didn't have a full campaign team. We didn't have an email list. We didn't have donors. We didn't have years of fundraising.
Now, as Fiorina gears up for yet another weekend campaigning in New Hampshire, her well-oiled super PAC behind her, those lean days seem long gone. For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
In the summer of 2011, an 11-year-old boy left Lakeview with 22 marks on his body, bruises on his throat and cheeks, abrasions on his shoulders, severe diaper rash. And his mother says he had also pulled fistfuls of hair from his own head.
That devastated me. I've never seen him like that.
Jennifer Cody lives in Lebanon, Maine. Her son, Ryan, had been at Lakeview for just over a month, and he'd had unexplained bruises before. That's what prompted Cody to pull him permanently.
They were just really odd marks. And so I went in and asked the social worker there, and she said, well, there's two different stories going around. She said, staff said that he did it to himself, and some kids in the residence said a staff member did it to him.
Cody called the police, who referred the case to the state's Division of Children, Youth, and Families. The state investigation never determined the cause of Ryan's injuries. 3 years later, Ryan's story became part of a Disability Rights Center investigation. It found Ryan was one of many residents who suffered abuse and neglect at Lakeview. The report also said in 2012, a 22-year-old man died, likely of neglect, in harm's way without support, and covering up abuse by other staff. In 2013, a mother claimed her daughter was abused and neglected more than 10 times. In one instance, a staffer picked her up off the ground by her collar. That client was Jessica Klerfeld, and her mother is Linda Blumkin of New York City. Blumkin admits her daughter is hard to handle.
I had reprimanded her about something, and the next thing I knew, I was lying on the sidewalk with Jessica kicking me, spitting on me, pulling my eyeglasses off, throwing them into the road.
That was the first time Klerfeld became violent, back in 2003, when she was 14. Klerfeld has autism, mild mental retardation, bipolar disorder, and a rare genetic disorder. She spent 3 years at Lakeview, and an investigation by the state of New York found her care lacking at all levels. When Klerfeld was suffering from a vaginal yeast infection, Lakeview's doctor prescribed her a foot fungal ointment. Blumkin says that doctor never even examined her daughter. The Board of Medicine is investigating this case.
Basically, we felt deceived. We felt that Lakeview had made promises to us that not only did they not keep, but it's inconceivable to me that they could have had an honest intention that they ever would keep them.
Lakeview declined to be interviewed for this story, citing ongoing investigations by the state. But a company representative did respond to some questions by email. Lakeview says it's very expensive to care for people with these types of disabilities. Blumkin became frustrated with New Hampshire regulators and sought the help of the New York Justice Center. And last year, the New York Justice Center, it took its concerns about Lakeview, that the facility might be operating outside the law, and alerted New Hampshire, specifically the office with the power to revoke Lakeview's license. That office is headed by John Martin.
Well, is that a matter that you will now be addressing?
In what way?
In what way?
Blumkin called Martin and secretly recorded the conversation.
Shows that according to your bureau, Lakeview has a clean record. They're a splendid facility that's not in violation of anything.
That's exactly right. As far as their clinical inspections go, they have been deficiency-free for at least the last 4 years.
The state does yearly unannounced visits to Lakeview. And at the same time New Hampshire inspectors concluded Lakeview residents received proper treatment, the New York Justice Center found major problems. The Justice Center also concluded New Hampshire's regulators weren't doing their jobs.
It's hard to say for certain, but the application to build the 192-mile Northern Pass transmission line is likely the most complicated that the state has ever had to review. So what's it like for 20,000-some-odd pages to land on your desk? Actually, that was only 500 pages. 20,000 would be more like this.
It looked like we were moving.
Lauren Collins, Northern Pass spokeswoman, says the company hand-delivered more than 40 copies of this document to state agencies, regulators, and every town along the route.
And we had to group everything around a giant factory room to keep it organized and make sure we had checked off all the boxes.
She says each of those copies, if printed out and laid end-to-end, would have been almost 4 miles long. Towns were given the option of taking it as a hard copy or digital, and most opted for the e-version. Sue Crotto, the office manager for the Board of Selectmen in the North Country town of Stark, says she was handed 4 thumb drives, all of them full.
I certainly don't have time in my day to go through 4 thumb drives and read everything in there.
But there are those who will do a lot of reading. The Department of Environmental Services, the Department of Transportation, and the Public Utilities Commission each have permits to review, legal opinions to solicit, due diligence to be done. DES got the lion's share of the paperwork, permits for disturbances to wetlands, for large-scale earthwork, for work along shorelands.
I've tried calling 3 separate staff people who I knew were probably going to be working on this project, and no one answered the phone. So I would imagine that they're probably reading this thing 24/7.
Nicholas Coates with the New Hampshire Association of Conservation.
It is so rainy out. Some people on the beach, not very many. But I did just see a woman walk by with a sweatshirt on, but unzipped and nothing on underneath. So I guess this is really happening here. I find 20 or so women on a pavilion stage, letting it all hang out. They're chatting, laughing, posing for TV news. It's crowded.
Excuse me.
25-year-old Samantha Durrett is standing off to the side next to her husband. She says she's here, topless, so their daughter can grow up in a world where she knows
that her body's okay, that it's not about the body, it's about who she is.
New Hampshire is famous for its live free or die mentality, and nobody's getting in the way of these women chilling with their shirts off. But a few passersby, one from Massachusetts, another from Montreal, tell me they are not impressed. It's families like these who started threatening to cancel their vacations here when they heard women would be topless at the beach. Republican State Rep Fred Rice says he can sympathize.
I mean, people always say, well, if you don't like it, you don't have to look.
No, you can't unring a bell, and you can't unlook what you've seen.
Rice tried to find a way to stop it, but New Hampshire is one of 32 states where the law allows women to go topless. Still, he calls the movement ridiculous.
This beach, for its entire existence, has tried to foster being a family beach.
Oh, my word. Family, family, family. What about the family?
Back in the pavilion, 54-year-old Heidi Lilly seems at ease without a shirt on. She says it wasn't until the 1930s that men began to go topless in public. And it's that arbitrary inequality that perpetuates harassment and crimes against women.
Society sexualizes the female breast, and it's in America only. Or primarily in America?
Lilly was just telling me this when the day got weirder and louder. Gawking men had climbed on the stage and were taking photos of the topless women with their smartphones. John Roy told me he thought this was a nipple contest.
It's not a contest then, I guess it's just a showing, a viewing.
That's when I finally spotted the organizer of Go Topless Day at Hampton Beach, Kia Sinclair. Only she wasn't topless. She was holding a towel tightly around her.
What do you make of all of this spectacle?
I don't like it, honestly. It gets to a point where all of a sudden these people all surround me to take pictures. Not everyone was asking.
Sinclair says if it weren't raining, there'd be hundreds of women sunbathing instead of just a handful on this stage like some kind of show.
But it proves my point about the sexualization, the obsession with breasts, that people feel the need to, like, stand here and stare at us.
Sinclair was heading home. But relative old-timer Heidi Lilly says the more women go topless, the less anyone will notice.
This is a new thing. This is totally brand new.
But even in libertarian New Hampshire, Hampton's Republican State Senator Nancy Stiles says baby steps. She's planning to propose a new law. It would let beach towns designate special areas for topless women or for families only. For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
When the New Hampshire Senate adopted its budget, Governor Hassan was quick with some highly qualified praise. On the bright side, the governor called the Senate plan an improvement over the House version. On the not-so-bright side, she called it unbalanced and said it could hurt families. The governor then laid down a marker. To be acceptable, state budgets need to be bipartisan.
Any budget that relies only on the votes of one party has not so far shown itself to meet the expectations of the people of New Hampshire or the needs of our businesses and our economy.
The budget now in effect, passed 2 years ago during the governor's first term, did have the cross-party support she says she so prizes, but came at a rare time when the legislature was divided. Dems ran the House, the GOP led the Senate. Finding other examples of bipartisan budgets is tough. Concord Democrat Mary Jane Wallner has served in the New Hampshire House since 1981.
You know, we have in the past done it.
But other than 2 years ago?
I think maybe there was a year, I can't remember exactly which year it was, when Governor Shaheen was governor. But, you know, it is rare.
One-party budgets have been the norm in Concord, regardless of which party is in control. It was certainly the case when Governor Hassan was the Senate's majority leader, which is one reason some Republicans consider her talk of bipartisan compromise fighting words.
She never has to pay for her ridiculous comments, and I wish she would.
That's 15-term Kingston State Rep Ken Wyler. Like plenty in the GOP, Wyler remains frustrated Hassan claimed political credit for the current budget, even though it was crafted mostly by Republicans in the Senate.
She was condemning it one day and congratulating herself for passing it the next day, and it was the same budget.
Either way, the budget's bipartisan flavor, it cleared the Senate 24-0, helped Hassan get reelected. In her next campaign, be it for governor or U.S. Senate, hangs over the next state budget. Hassan has said she'll share her plans for 2016 when the budget's put to bed. What's already clear, however, is that Republicans aren't eager to have the process help Hassan again.
As governor, Hassan first proposed a $1 billion spending increase. After that, $700 million more. To pay for it?
Indiana-based Impact America Action is spending $1 million to air TV ads coinciding with budget negotiations. The New Hampshire Republican Party, meanwhile, is taking aim with a shutdown clock, suggesting state functions will grind to a halt if Hassan doesn't strike a deal with Republicans by July 1st. GOP leaders in the state House move fast to discredit that idea, but that doesn't mean Republicans plan to send the governor a budget she'll much like.
Owen LaBrie and his family wept as the verdicts were read in court. If given the maximum sentence, LaBrie could face up to 11 years in prison. A jury found LaBrie guilty of having sex with a minor and using a computer to lure her in, but he was acquitted on 3 counts of aggravated sexual assault. Each of those charges included 20 years behind bars. Outside the courtroom, Laura Dunn, a victim's right advocate who spoke for the family, said they were pleased LaBrie was held accountable, but said were disheartened that the school did not do enough to stop this so-called senior salute tradition from happening.
We still feel betrayed by St. Paul's schools as they allowed and fostered a toxic culture and left our daughter and several other students at risk of sexual violence. We trusted the school to protect her, and it failed us.
LaBrie walked out.
Before streaming inside to deliver the petition to Governor Maggie Hassan, pipeline opponents gathered in front of the State House to talk about what they don't like about the Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline, or NED. Marianne Harper lives in Ringe and says their opposition can't be defined as a NIMBY issue.
You'll find it was coined in the 1980s and basically means that a group wants something or recognizes the need for something. They just don't want it located or sited near them. Well, guess what? We don't need NED, and we don't want it anywhere.
The need for additional natural gas pipelines has been identified by the New England Independent System Operator, which manages the region's electric grid, as well as various state and regional industry interest groups. For NHPR News, I'm Sam Evans-Brown.
This is All Things Considered on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Peter Biello. Federal Election Commission reports released today shed more light on the finances of 1st District Congressman Frank Ginta. Last month, we learned Ginta had settled campaign finance violations with the FEC over $355,000 Ginta plowed into his 2010 campaign, and that he'd agreed to refund the money and pay a $15,000 fine. Ginta has said and continues to say he had a right to the money, which came from accounts under the control of his parents. But the FEC found, and Ginta's lawyer signed onto a settlement, that the money amounted to illegal campaign contributions. Here to bring us up to speed on what the new information out from the FEC is NHPR's Josh Rogers. So, Josh, these documents reflect the FEC's work on the Ginta matter. What's the big takeaway?
Well, Peter, I guess the biggest is that Congressman Ginta's version of things, or I guess I should say his latest version of things, that the $355,000 he funneled to his campaign committee came from a family account in which he held a, quote, equitable interest, isn't shared by his own family. Ginta's mother, Virginia, who wrote 9 of the 10 checks Ginta received, wrote loan on the memo line of each one of those checks and told the FEC she expected to be repaid.
Now the reports also suggest that Ginta used money from his parents for his mayoral races, too.
Yes, that information apparently came from Frank Ginta himself as part of what the FEC refers to as his, quote, family pot defense, that the account on which his parents' checks were drawn was an account that family members, including Ginta's brother and sister, could tap for various expenses. In affidavits to the FEC, he said he had, quote, a specific commitment and pledge from his parents that the money in those accounts were his to access. The FEC says there's no documentary evidence to suggest that's true. Frank Ginta's mother told the FEC that she and Ginta's father had decided to make $1 million available to each of their 3 children, and that when she wrote checks to Ginta, she, quote, deducted those amounts from his $1 million allotment, which he referred to as fungible and not certain. The FEC report also says that Ginta's sister told investigators she had no idea about any so-called family pot account or that she or her brothers enjoyed any rights to any funds.
Another thing Congressman Ginta has said about this matter is that he hasn't simply been the beneficiary of this so-called family account, but he himself has contributed to it.
Yes, he said he put in more money than he ever got out. The FEC called that claim unsupported in September.
It was a quiet summer night in June when EMTs in Laconia got the call of a possible overdose at a nearby house. When they arrived, roommates showed them into a bedroom with posters on the wall, laundry spread on the floor, and a snowboard laid up against a dresser. A 29-year-old man was lying on the ground, not breathing. He had overdosed on OxyContin and fentanyl. He was wearing pastel board shorts and a T-shirt. He looked young and fit. EMTs got right to work, at first giving him Narcan up his nose.
You want
Nasally? Well,
yeah,
I am.
I'll give it nasally.
Yep. They don't
get
know.
It in there.
But when his heart rate and breathing did not increase, EMTs gave him Narcan through an IV. He woke up in a matter of seconds.
He just gave the Narcan.
Yep.
So let's flush it in.
Put your fingers on this.
Respirations are up to 10. Eyes are opening.
All right. All right.
97.2. Pulse is 105.
Lay back. Hey, bud.
Lay back.
Hey, bud.
Lay back.
Hey there. We got
it's coming okay. out of your nose. Lay back.
Whoa.
Hey,
sit down.
Hey,
it's
lay right. down.
It's okay, bud. With
lay
the
down.
Department. It's
lay
okay.
down. Do a bunch of Narcan to wake you up.
It's all right, bud.
What did you take?
You're good, man.
Do you know what did this to you?
Last year, Narcan was given roughly 1,900 times statewide. This year, the state has reached almost half that number in just the first 4 months. Lieutenant Jason Bean with the Laconia Fire Department says in Laconia alone, Narcan has been used more than 60 times since January.
It's absolutely a life-saving tool that if we get there in time, Narcan almost instantly reverses whatever they're overdosing on if it's a narcotic-based drug like that. And it's probably one of the more important drugs that we're carrying now, especially with this epidemic.
That's why lawmakers and the governor supported legislation this year to get Narcan to more people, including police officers, family and friends, and even addicts. But so far, the rollout has been slow. As of this year, training requirement for police officers who carry...
Richard Vaughn.
Richard Vaughn stands before Second Circuit Court Judge John Peter Sear in Littleton. The date is July 8th, 2014.
Mr. Vaughn, do you know why you're here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Vaughn is here in court because he owes $895 from a DWI. It's been a while since he's made a payment toward the debt, and Judge Sear asks Vaughn how he's going to pay it.
Your Honor, I've been out. I had an interview at Pizza Hut the day before yesterday. I've applied at Applebee's and a lot of places, and I'm just really trying hard to get a job right now so I can pay this fine.
At this moment, the ACLU's Gilles Bissonnette says the court should have given Vaughn the option of a public attorney, and the court should have tried to figure out if he had enough money to pay the fine.
Mr. Vaughn has no idea what his rights are, and he's sitting there, and I think you could hear it from his voice, terrified.
I know that I have to pay this fine.
He did not go in that day thinking that he was going to be jailed. And then moments later, he was ordered to go to jail for 18 days. I mean, that is an amazing amount of time.
18 days in jail. That's a day for every $50 in debt. That's state law. But there's also federal law going back to the 1800s and Supreme Court decisions in more recent years. And here comes a word you'll hear a few times in this story, willful. The law is clear that you should only go to prison for willfully not paying a fine.
And so what we talk about in our report is just how clear and how settled the law is, and unfortunately, how systemic it is in New Hampshire for that constitutional principle to not be followed.
And the shocking thing about the report...
Buzz Scher is a professor at the UNH School of Law and a co-author of the report. He says courts are making two errors here. One, poor people shouldn't go to jail for not paying fines they can't afford. And two, when judges threaten jail time, they often aren't offering public attorneys to poor people.
What we're seeing is a non-application of those two principles. It's not a misapplication. There's just no ability to pay hearings occurring. And none of these people, in 50% of the cases, we estimate there's nobody is getting a lawyer.
So let's look at the numbers. In 2013, the year the report analyzes, the circuit court system heard 83,000 cases related to fines. And in 289 of those cases, courts jailed people for not paying. The ACLU pulled court records and analyzed 39 of those cases to draw larger conclusions. And the ACLU concludes poor defendants were routinely jailed without determining if they were able to pay the fine. And in most cases, the defendant wasn't offered a public attorney. The report details three examples, all of which you'll hear in this story. Now, Ed Kelly, the judge in charge of the circuit court system, says the ACLU's numbers don't add up to a statewide problem.
I think it would be wrong for anyone to form conclusions based upon any three cases. I mean, candidly, you or anybody listening to this report would have to ask themselves, are there three instances in my life and my work over the last year that I would not want somebody to be recording and listening to?
So keep that in mind as you hear from a guy named Dennis Supernant, one of the minority of cases the ACLU identified where the defendant did have an attorney.
I will say this. He's not going to be leaving here today until he pays his attorney's fees. They've been due since December of 2012. So that has to be paid today. That's $302.50.
That's the voice of Judge Thomas Bamberger in the Nashua Circuit Court, February 2014. Supernant, the defendant, was homeless and owed attorney's fees, but was about to start a new job. Public defender Suzanne Ketteridge and the judge debate the points.
But he has done something. Mm-hmm. He went into rehab. He got a job. That has to count for something.
It does. It allows him to pay his OCC fee.
And if he can't come up with the money today, what will happen?
He'll go to jail until he pays it. That's what happens.
Which means he'll lose his job. He'll go right back to where he was before.
Judge Bamberger ordered Supernant to pay $90 on the spot, everything he had to his name, and then told him to pay the rest within 2 days or face jail time. Gilles Bissonnette says the next day, though, the ACLU filed an emergency petition to the...
At the Ski Mountains Base Lodge, cashier Jean Brousseau says she heard Vladimir Popov singing earlier, but she's not sure where he is now. She loves to hear him sing, she says, even though in the 15 years he's worked here, she's never understood a word of it.
It's all in Russian and Latin or Italian or something. I would really love to hear him sing Silent Night or Oh Holy Night in English. Can you imagine that?
Brousseau directs me outside. Go find Butch, she says. He'll know where Popov is. I find Butch Cushing near the snow machines. In charge of lift operations, Cushing sent Popov to the high country lift today.
When you get to the top,
yeah,
just go to the next lift. He'll be at the base of that next lift.
Cushing escorts me to the lower lift and waits as my chair comes around.
Sometimes, you know, even the people from his country will come and they recognize him. I had one come up to me and said, "Do you know who's running that J-bag?"
It's a 10-minute ride, and when I get to the top, I don't need to ask for directions. A group of snowboarders glide in toward Popov. After they're away, Popov squints at me from a distance. He knows why I'm here, but he's wary. The last story about him didn't turn out well.
4 years ago, they come in here. They ask me singing. They publish it. This is not ask me nothing. And the guy make me like loser. Why this is guy doing in the mountain? After a career like this.
Usually, the story goes the other way. The unknown singer gets a break and leaves behind the little job in the mountains. But the retired tenor says he's never been happier. He's outside, he's in the mountains. He sings when he wants.
I start singing very young, yeah. Because my mother have a good voice. Yeah. And later I go Soviet military. And I go study after military. I go like a study in conservatory.
He studied for 6 years before winning a coveted spot in the Bolshoi Opera. And then, in 1982, while studying at La Scala in Milan.
I defected, actually. Not immigrated, defected.
In jeans and a t-shirt, he walked into the American consulate.
Oh, this is scary stuff. I don't expect it myself, too.
After the initial interview, Popov was told he could return to his hotel and someone would be in touch.
I said, where I go? Yeah. I go outside, maybe KGB wait for me already, you know.
What happened then?
They let me stay inside,
okay.
Consulate, you know. And guy gave me actually case of beer because my birthday I defected. Budweiser, I remember, Budweiser, yeah.
3 days later, Popov was flown to New York, put up in a hotel, and given $40.
I make an audition immediately. City Opera take it me for opening season, Tosca. Yeah. Metropolitan Opera take it me. And Lorin Mazel, but I said, Metropolitan Opera, I'm here.
Here's a 1991 recording of Popov singing in Mussorgsky's Kovanchina with Claudio Abbado conducting.
This kind of a life of the opera singers. Travel, travel, travel. But I see the whole world. The four opera imported in the world. La Scala, Metropolitan Opera New York, Royal Opera Covent Garden in London, and Vienna State Opera.
During the 18 years that followed his defection, Popov sang in all those great opera houses. He met and married Lucy, whose family connections in New Hampshire resulted in the move to Waterville. But, he says, a career in opera is a lot like a career in Hollywood. And so in 2000, when he was 54, Popov retired from singing and took a job at the ski mountain.
People like it, this go in the lift, my voice travel far away. The girls are only today, she coming from the top, say, hey, Vladimir, I heard you're there. Yeah.
And as opposed to the more formal divide of the stage, here on the mountain, skiers can approach him when he's done and let him know what they think.
And he started singing, and I turned around and I just immediately gave him a hug because I was crying at the time. It was beautiful.
For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
Good morning. It's 7:04. I'm Rick Ganley with NHPR News. A Newington company that wants to transport propane by rail on the seacoast has reached an agreement with neighbors who have stood in opposition to the project for 2 years. NHPR's Emily Corwin has more on the unexpected resolution.
The agreement limits railcar traffic and includes fire safety measures paid for by C3, which hopes to bring in American propane over tracks between Newfields and an expanded facility in Newington. For 2 years, residents and cities along the tracks, as well as the Great Bay stewards, fought against the project. They feared a rail explosion. Rich DiPentima lives along the railroad.
This is better than what we would have gotten if we did nothing.
Friday morning, all objecting parties will agree to withdraw their concerns from the state's site evaluation committee in exchange for C3's concessions. Later that afternoon, the committee will decide if C3 can begin its expansion immediately. For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
Bernie Sanders has officially enrolled in the New Hampshire Democratic presidential primary.
Somewhere I'm supposed to sign this thing, I think, right?
Okay. Although there was talk that the independent Vermont senator might have some trouble being on the Democratic ballot, Sanders told the press he's fulfilled all the requirements.
You know, when you have the chairperson of the Vermont Democratic Party saying that I am a Democrat and should be on the ballot, when you have the chairman of the New Hampshire Democratic Party saying I'm a Democrat and should be on the ballot, I don't have to prove too much more.
After Sanders filed, he was greeted with hundreds of supporters who filled the statehouse lawn. On Wednesday, Democratic candidate Martin O'Malley filed. Hillary Clinton is expected to file on Monday. It's another full day for presidential candidates on the campaign trail. Meanwhile, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie will hold a pair of town hall meetings today. He'll start this morning in Somersworth, and he'll speak to voters again this afternoon at a pub in Hanover. Former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina will hold several events in the state today, including a stop at a Stratford County GOP rally this evening in Dover. And Ohio Governor John Kasich is expected to be at the State House in Concord later this morning to file for the New Hampshire primary. Kasich will hold the town hall meeting later in the day in Hopkinton. In sports, the Capitals beat the Bruins. 4-1 was the final last night. That was the first road loss of the season for Boston. We'll see more clouds than sun across the Granite State today. There is a shower possible later this afternoon. It'll be breezy, highs in the 60s and lower 70s. Clouds and a chance for an evening shower, then clearing skies after midnight with temperatures in the 40s to low 50s. Sunshine in southern counties on Saturday. We'll see more clouds as you head farther north. Cooler with temperatures in the 50s statewide. Mostly sunny and cool on Sunday.